I know. It is.
For the April 8th special meeting of the Planning and Development Committee of Council. And we don't have any minutes to review. This is a continuation of last Monday's meeting. And first thing I'd like to ask is if there is anyone who would like to make any public comments. This is, yes. So if you would go to the podium and give your name and a couple of minutes, name, address, and a couple of minutes, that would be good.
Okay. Good morning. I'm Wendy Bauerschmidt, 1320 Woodlake Court. And as you consider hotel zoning as a separate zoning classification, I'd like to encourage you to include a workforce housing component in that, because the majority of hotel jobs do not pay enough for employees to live in Mount Pleasant. For example, based on the most recent numbers, the average rent in Mount Pleasant is $1,567. And that would equate to a $27 an hour wage in order to qualify for that hotel at three times income. And so as a result, the majority of hotel workers can't afford to live in Mount Pleasant, and the commute increases traffic and is leading to the statistic that over 70% of the workforce does not live in Mount Pleasant. I understand that it's a challenge because the inclusionary zoning bill is stuck in the State House, but I'm bringing up the conversation to elevate the conversation because the community and the business community needs to be aware. There is a city that has included hotel zoning and inclusionary zoning in Portland, Maine. They've just adopted legislation that requires one unit per 28 hotel units. Or a payment of $3,800 per hotel unit. So there is an example. Even though it may be difficult, I encourage you to strongly consider some sort of residential component to hotel development, because while hospitality is an important part of our community and our economic viability, let's do it in a way that supports the quality of life for visitors and residents alike.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else? If you give your name, address, and 2 minutes, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is James Wilson. I'm an attorney with Wombelbond Dickinson here on behalf, my address is 722 Dragoon Drive in Creekside. I'm here on behalf of Ferry Wharf LLC, and here with Mike Bennett and Tracy Ray, Jack Bennett, and Troy Miller. If we have an opportunity to present when our matter comes before the board here on the agenda, I can hold off till then. I just want to make sure we have an opportunity to speak. So I'll defer to you, Mr. Chairman, whether we should speak now or then.
Well, if you have general comments to make, if there are questions we have of the submittal, we'll ask those.
Okay. So well, it sounds like I better go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'll spare the background for the most part of this PD, but it was adopted in 2012. It's been amended twice with fairly minor tweaks, and this is basically now a third amendment. We went before Planning Commission a couple weeks ago, and there was a lot of discussion about any increase to the residential cap that's on right now, the Ferry Wharf area, which is comprised of the waterfront and boulevard districts of the PD. Has a cap of 73 residential units, and we had originally asked to increase that to 150. As staff will describe, we have withdrawn that request entirely. We are only requesting to keep the exact same number of 73 residential units. The other point I just want to flag, we've talked with staff about this. The PD calls for a bus pullout. There already is a bus pullout on Holman Boulevard across the street from the Ferry Wharf property. What we've asked is to basically defer construction of that bus pullout until the area adjacent to it is going to be developed. The reason we ask that is because there's already a southbound bus stop at the waterfront park, which is actually closer to Ferry Wharf than where this one would go down toward Patriots Boulevard. So so we would just ask that the board or the committee consider that additional tweak to the PD amendment here. I think that otherwise you all are probably familiar with what the PD amendment does. It really just does a couple things. It clarifies when these traffic improvements will be built. It combines what we call the waterfront and gateway districts because we had some uncertainty and confusion about how that's supposed to work. And then lastly, it allows for conversion without any increase on the total either no increase on residential and no increase on traffic, meaning the traffic limits were set with the original PD with the impact assessment, and this would keep us entirely within those limits.
Okay.
So hopefully that helps you all in terms of consideration, but please do ask us questions as you're considering. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Can I speak?
Oh, certainly. Give us your name and address in a couple of minutes.
My name is Michael Bennett with Ferry Wharf, 143 Trad Street, Charleston, South Carolina. I just wanted to clarify our own attorney's comments. He had mentioned, because this is what's been a little confusing the whole way, we were in order, the request 2 weeks ago would have enabled us to increase residential density by a total of 77 units on 18 acres. In order to do that, we would have had to reduce the hotel rooms and reduce commercial space. So it, kind of what you were referring to, we heard loud and clear that the town was sensitive to the residential component, but we never asked just to increase the residential components. We always said we'll give up something to increase the residential. So it was not just an increase on residential. It was a reduction of hotel or commercial space. That's just the one comment that's consistently out there that I believe is inaccurate or misleading. And I'll be glad to answer any questions if you all have during the hearing.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Is there anyone else? Yes. Hey, Mr. Carmody. Sure. Good.
Yes, I'm Charlie Carmody. I live at 107 New Street in the Old Village of Mount Pleasant. And I'm here to encourage you not to change the height restrictions on the corner of Mathis Ferry Road, the old Miller Cadillac site. I represent the family. We are working with a group to sell that property to get it developed. It is the entranceway into the town of Mount Pleasant, and I think if there is a site in the town that is appropriate for an 80-foot height restriction, that is it. So I just want to throw that in and let you know that I would like for you to leave the height restriction alone on that site.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to speak during the public comment period? Going once? Okay. Thank you. Jeff, you're up.
Yes, sir. So this first one is a PD amendment request. As Mr. Wilson and Mr. Bennett have referenced, it's for Bridgeside 2, and it includes a couple of components that we'll summarize for you. But we'll get started with the geographic area that's outlined here is what we're talking about. And the waterfront portion is to the left, sort of in this part of the PD. And then the boulevard area is this piece. And originally, this other area in here was called the Park District, which is now under two separate ownerships. So the work here has been focused on blending what's left of those two sub-districts with now one property owner and tying it all together. Here it is again in terms of a land use plan designation, which is waterfront gateway, and the zoning is a separate PD, plan development district, and it is part of the 80-foot height limit with the boulevard overlay that we have in place today. So we'll summarize here. It was done back in 2012 when waterfront gateway district was being created, but it was ahead of that process, but as many elements as were possible were included in this PD at the time. And again, there were three separate sub-districts, and you can see in item two the amounts of floor space for office, commercial, a grand total of 573 multifamily dwellings and 450 hotel rooms. And as mentioned, we've been working with now three or four different owners. So it's one of the things that happens with planned development districts. It starts out really great as one owner, one project, one development, but in reality it doesn't come to pass that way. And the Bennett Group has now these two sub-districts that we're tying together. This was the approved conceptual plan at the time in 2012. It has been modified as portions of it have gone through DRB, Design Review Board. They have that ability to kind of shift buildings and relocate things. But generally, the zoning and the uses are in the same places. The first request was, as mentioned, creating a system where there was effectively a trip bank or a trip cap based on what was done in 2012, and it would allow the applicant at their discretion underneath that limit to be able to convert out different land uses for other land uses. So you might be able to say, well, they might be able to say, we're not going to build the grand total number of hotel rooms. We would like to take 40 of those rooms that are excess, quote unquote, transfer them into, say, retail or office space. So that was the gist of the main request, was to create this mechanism, all again underneath sort of a grand total of trips as analyzed from all the uses that were approved originally. They were going to, as mentioned, request that they could convert some of that to yield 77 additional residential units, which would have been a grand total of 150, but that has now since changed since the Planning Commission saw this request. The second part combines Waterfront and Boulevard into one district, so that makes it easier for everybody to administer. And then the remaining piece is the existing apartment development on the other side of Hallman Boulevard. The commercial has already been programmed, so any of this, that would be a use that conversion wouldn't occur out of into other uses, but they could convert other uses to commercial under this mechanism. And the final request or component is the roadway improvement timing, picking that up and ensuring that that gets handled as part of future development so we don't lose that particular requirement. And so there were various pieces that we as a staff evaluated for the Planning Commission, had some concerns about the open space, but that's been since cleared up and the percentage requirement will stay the same. There were areas on the conceptual that were unclear as in terms of what kind of development would occur. And under D, excuse me, the concern that we had was connections between this development and adjoining developments right nearby, but unfortunately some of that existing development did not account for future connections. So it's there. The streets are lined up. The potential to be able to make future connections someday, whether vehicular and or pedestrian, might be there, but it would require the adjoining property owners to be involved with making physical improvements on their site. So here's the proposed new conceptual, laying out the various buildings. A, B, and C buildings are now under construction. E and F buildings have been to design review board, so those are moving forward. And then you can see the various buildings and then allowed square footages or number of units or hotel rooms by location or tagged to those designated building sites. L and K in this part, again, were the Boulevard area, but they've been merged, so we would treat the whole thing together utilizing this new sort of key, reference key as we would move forward. And then here it is updated where it removes the extra units that were being requested for the residential and gives you ranges, minimums and maximums for the various office, commercial, residential, and hotel rooms, so those four main uses. Here's the slide from the original where we were looking at the open space. One final point here is that as we move forward, we would require the applicants, when they come in with their individual site plans, to provide us an updated chart so that we're able to monitor this conversion mechanism or, you know, equivalency in terms of trips, so that we can keep track of that into the future. And any future development is obviously subject to DRB. Mr. Morrison reviewed and covered the transportation aspects of this. A lot of it was the sort of technical and making sure that it was clear how this conversion would work. And Brad provided some edits and comments that have now since been incorporated into the new document. As mentioned, Planning Commission recommended denial of the request 5-1. The primary concern was the additional residential units, although, again, we're working under a total trip count, and an associated concern about having as much non-residential office and or commercial here as opposed to residential. So with that, we'll stop and be ready to answer any questions.
Okay. Just to make certain that I understand, the trip cap remains as it was?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the square footage or the residential units, they wanted to go from 73 to 150, and it's back to 73 now.
Yes.
So
and those would be, at this point, located in buildings I and J, so on the southern end of the project.
Okay. So, and then the 77 additional residential units that had been referenced here.
You can eliminate any of those references.
That can be eliminated, and that square footage is going to commercial?
No.
Is it, or it's just going away?
Going away.
Just going away. Okay. Everybody's nodding here, so I guess we're just going away. Okay. GM, Bob, questions?
On the bus pullout, does staff have an opinion on the need for that bus pullout at this time, or is it? And I saw in the language there that it will happen. It's just deferred to a later date.
About lost the mic there. Staff's comment and position about installation of the second bus pullout was really a result of discussions with the previous owner, and the fact that the PD mentions bus pullouts and the arrangement of such would be kind of determined by staff. We felt and, you know, still feel that it's needed, and for our perspective, it's always better to have it than wait down the road to not have it because something else happened. So, I mean, that's the position. If you wanted to consider a different trigger, I think the trigger right now is anything beyond buildings ABC, then that's up to you. We just want to emphasize that there is a need for it, and we would like to see it happen.
I was fortunate enough to go sit through Planning Commission and listen to the original proposal, which kind of takes me a little off guard today because I had things prepared and now I don't know what to say. Actually, I think, guys, that your timing to ask for flexibility in land use could not be worse given recent events. So I'm really glad to see that part's been pulled because that would have been a tough sell, I think. So happy to see the additional residential gone. Brad, I know at the Planning Commission there were some questions about the trip equivalency and what that really means and whether we're comparing apples to apples from the original proposal to what's being done now. Can you just comment on that? Do you
right.
feel comfortable with what?
Yes, and we've worked extensively both with their engineer, their traffic engineer, as well as James to get the wording and the tables and everything as accurate as possible. But, you know, the bottom line is, like Mr. Alma said, is the preceding PD set a limit, a total gross trips. They can, and that's the cap, and you'll see that in a table in the PD amendment, that they cannot exceed that. We have the table arranged so they can change the uses within the limits, the brackets, as long as they stay at or under those trips. So it's limited by that preceding PD and gives the flexibility like the PD is asking for just to convert one to another.
Okay, thanks. And just, Mr. Alma, there was a lot of discussion about the trips and that being part of the impact assessment. But the impact assessment is much more than transportation. It deals with all the impacts of a potential project.
Yes.
I didn't hear much discussed about whether these changes would have any other impact in terms of what was originally approved.
As you deal with it probably every day, traffic is the primary issue. But other impacts, really the uses have been set, and those sort of expectations and maximums were already analyzed, so we didn't look at any other external impacts for the project. Other than the open space comment that we had, but they'll be able to provide the required amount of open space in this new arrangement, mm-hmm. As opposed to what that original conceptual was. But that was the only, really it's the traffic. That.
Okay. And just one question for the applicant. So the standard that I sort of use now with amending PDs is how does it benefit the town? And I understand how this benefits you all, but for us to go back and change in a previously approved plan, can you maybe just speak to what benefit does the town get from approving this? Mr. Bennett, would you go to the mic, please?
Michael Bennett, since we pulled the residential, that's obviously a significant lessening of the benefit to Ferry Wharf. From an aesthetic standpoint, I can build what I can build if y'all don't change the butt, okay? And what that will require me to do, and my entire site is zoned for 80 feet. In the heart of this site on E and F and G, I would like to make those significantly lower, and I think it enhances the development and it makes it, for lack of a better word, a prettier development. I'll show you what I'm referring to. This is what we want E and F to look like, three-story buildings. We're entitled to go 80 feet here. We're going about 30 feet here, 35 feet here. Try to give it kind of an old village look. There'd be some retail and coffee or whatever on the first floor. Boutique hotel on the second and third floor. This could have been residential had we wanted to set it. Get the additional residential, that went away. It will be a boutique hotel on the second and third floor. And then also on track G.
Mr. Bennett, would you mind getting in front of the microphone so we can record? Thank you.
And then in front of track G, which we've not submitted to DRB yet, we're trying to keep those, again, which are entitled and zoned for 80 feet, to try to make those 1 to 3 story buildings. And then we would be able to push a little more density down where it says L and K. When we bought all this property many, many years ago and bought the PUD entitlement that we had, it was always a conceptual site plan. It was never anticipated by the town or by the previous owner that it would be restricted to this district. That was somewhat of an arbitrary line, and nothing that's happened over there followed those original guidelines. So it was always anticipated this 35 acres was entitled to what it was entitled to. I bought 18 of those 35 acres, and it was always anticipated that you would move it around that property. This just secures that, right, because it's a little unclear. Most importantly, it enables me to create this classic Main Street lower buildings through the heart of the project, and that was really my motivation.
Thank you. I remember when I first saw this plan as a planning commissioner years and years ago, I think what was presented at that time was very similar to what you're showing us today. So it wasn't 80-foot buildings. So I think it's important when we do amend these things that we make sure there's a clear benefit to the town and not just to the applicant. So it sounds like we might get some lower heights here as well.
Just to be clear, those 77 apartments, they're gone forever if it is approved, correct?
Right.
Okay.
You would have to look at it in a separate future PD amendment if that were something they would consider. But as of this, he doesn't want to come back.
Okay. So as Bob says, the benefit of the town as of right now would be the lower heights and less density with the apartments going on.
Well, and I think it's important to say that if we approve this, those lower heights aren't guaranteed unless you're making a commitment on the record today. But this is something that he's saying he wants to do, and I'd certainly take him at his word, but this certainly would not require those lower heights if something were to change in the future, I guess. So
yeah,
this would be a matter of just kind of trusting.
Well, the zoning is the zoning, but yeah. I would like to think that if he's come to this committee of council with that proposal, that is his current idea and where he wants to go with this. Okay, so does anyone have a motion for a recommendation to council?
Mr. Chair, I'll go ahead and recommend approval for item 2A on the agenda as it's currently stated, with a couple of notes. One being that these 77 units are no longer part of the approval, and that the bus stop be constructed as originally approved.
Okay.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any other questions or discussion?
I just add that bus stop piece. As being a CARTA board member, we're always trying to encourage those bus stops to be built when they're as early as possible. So I think I agree with Mr. Morrison that now would be the appropriate time to do so.
Okay. Okay. We have a motion. Have a second. We've had discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. We'll recommend. That'll be a recommendation of approval to the full council.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Okay.
Go below.
Number three.
Next item is a request from SCENG for easements along Mathis Ferry Road on town property as a continuation of the effort to place the overhead power lines underground. Mr. Cave has been coordinating this with the utility company, and there are six different locations along the corridor that affect our property. One point is that we wanted to identify is that on the Armory property that we own, there will be ultimately a couple of large utility boxes there in the front, but we just wanted to let you know that that's part of this project for their ability to connect and make the proper connections there. So these are the six requested locations. That's it.
Okay. I read in the paper this morning that SCENG is going away, or is that just going to change name to Old Dominion, or what is?
Dominion Energy, I think, is the new name.
So they're requesting the easement, or SCEG is requesting it'll pass on?
Yes.
To them? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I think that this is an important thing for the safety of our town residents. And with the weather that we get here and again, having these power lines underground would be a reduction in burden, I think, on our public services and on the system. So I think this is a positive thing.
Okay. Bob?
No comment.
Okay. Do we have any other questions for staff? Is this from the easements? Is this going to, you have to ask this, how's that going to impact trees and roots and all that?
It'll help them in the long term.
It's going to help in the long term?
I believe so. Gets the conflicts out of the way and underground.
Okay. All righty. Anything further? Do we have a motion?
Move to approve item number 3, easements on Mathis Ferry Road. Recommendation to approve to full council.
Okay.
A second.
Motion and a second to recommend approval to full council. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Okay. Telecommunications towers.
This is an item returning to you from the last committee meeting, and based on your direction, we took another look at how to deal with telecommunications towers in the PI2 zoning district. Recall that town property and MPW properties are the ones zoned PI2. And so this recommendation would make a tower a conditional use in that district, and rather than a special exception use needing review by BOZA as now required. And however, in the PI1, as well as AB and AB2, where telecommunications towers allowed, those would stay as special exceptions and have that extra review by Board of Zoning Appeals. The related language that you see in here is some additional cleanups and clarifications. And one of the points that we raised before, it made it appear as though the regulations would require two different steps. If BOZA was reviewing something and the applicant came in with one tower or an antenna for their own use and then later wanted to do co-locations, it's almost like you couldn't anticipate that. You'd have to come back later. And we made sure it was clear that the height of a tower could be studied and looked at, one for the primary user, and then any additional height for co-locations could be dealt with in one fell swoop. So that's what the language shows here, and we've made those changes for your review at this point. So again, and then the conditions, I mean the requirements of this, because it's a conditional use, that you see extensive conditions that in the ordinance that have to be met, and but these would be reviewed. The actual site plan would then be reviewed by staff, provided it meets all the conditions elsewhere in the ordinance. And it 156-119 goes on for two pages with the other requirements. Location, the whole discussion of things like fall zones, engineering requirements, et cetera, et cetera.
And perhaps I missed it. You're not, and perhaps you are, saying that if one pole goes up, who would be the approver of the second pole if it was requested?
If it was as set up, it would be, if it needed special exception review under those other zoning districts. So PI, AB, and AB2 would be the Board of Zoning Appeals. In the other, it would be staff looking at, you know, would be able to look at the height of the towers like we're able to do now.
Okay. But someone is going to be looking at it.
Yes.
Mm. Okay. Jim, Bob?
So this addresses minimum setback from the center as well as fall zone, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So the minimum setback on these towers would be if it's adjacent to a residential zone property, it'd have to be the height of the tower, or that's the fall zone?
I think that's the requirement.
Okay.
If it's residential, it changes if it's non-residential and or a public right-of-way.
Okay, that's all I have.
I think my concern with this is that we're getting to the same result through a different avenue. So because the original request was for rezoning so that they could put this monopole up, and now it's just changing the PL2 so they can still put the monopole up. But I feel like we heard loud and clear from citizens and residents right around that zone that they don't want a monopole in that location and don't feel it's appropriate for the neighborhood. So I don't see why it can't remain a special exception and go through BOZA, go through the public process rather than leaving it to staff. I'm not comfortable with this as it is.
Question, was it the neighbors, was it that they didn't want a monopole or they didn't want the tank to go away?
I think both. I think they didn't want a monopole and they didn't want the tank to go away. I mean, I think the tank might go away regardless, right? If it's a safety issue. But,
I don't know. That's going to be MPW's call.
Yeah, but I think the original request for the rezoning had people up in arms, not simply because they didn't want it rezoned to light industrial because they were concerned about future use, but because I think there was a sense that they did not want the monopole.
Okay. Bob?
Yeah, when I asked Mr. Duffy that question in the last meeting, I said, why don't you just go through BOZA? I didn't really get a clear answer as to why, other than maybe it would be less predictable, or I don't know. He didn't really answer that, so I'm not clear on why BOZA still isn't an option as well. But I guess he's not here today to answer the question. But
yeah, my concern is that if they're not able to keep some type antenna in there, all the water meters now, whether we like it or not, all the water meters rely on some sort of an antenna because they have transmitters on every water box, and the other is cell phone service in the old village and not just the old village, the old part of Mount Pleasant. And I don't know if there's any replacement for that.
If I understand GM's comment, though, it's not necessarily the end result. That's the issue. It's the process of getting there. And, you know, BOZA is a mechanism to get there today that could be used as opposed to I don't particularly have an issue either way. I'll go ahead and make a motion for approval of the amendment?
Text amendment.
Regarding towers in PI 2 district.
Okay, and I'll go ahead and second it. Okay, we have a motion and a second. All those, any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Okay, so it's 2-1. I'm sure Tom would wish he was here for that.
Just a question, I probably should have asked this before the vote, but it can be considered, I guess, for full council. But if this were to go through BOZA, then we wouldn't have all these conditions in place, would we?
There are some conditions that they still would need to meet.
But not all the ones listed in this text
amendment.
Right,
if you have the conditional uses and those requirements, if an applicant can meet the standards in the code, then we're obligated to approve administratively a land use, whether tower or other conditional uses.
So actually this would have more restrictions or more conditions as opposed to if BOZA approved it.
BOZA, when they review something, they can add conditions. So they have that flexibility of responding to a particular issue and putting additional conditions on it, which staff couldn't do.
Correct. Okay, thank you.
Okay. Comprehensive plan and council review schedule. And let me ask a question right from, when does our old comprehensive plan expire or age out?
I believe the 2009, I guess it is, comprehensive plan, the one that was basically 10 years ago when we redid, it was either September or October of 2009. So September, October.
Of this year?
Yes, sir. Okay. So what we had, obviously, you know, as you recall, Planning Commission recommended the draft plan to full council in February of this year. And so we've been trying to work with getting together a schedule for your review of this document. So what we have been thinking about doing was giving, you know, I know there, you know, individuals have questions and there's a lot to look at in that plan. So we had kind of been talking as staff about the idea of offering an opportunity to meet with a couple council members at a time, to have some individual workshops, just to kind of walk through, these are the specifics, answer any particular questions you may have. Just kind of on a more informal basis as we, you know, got this ball rolling, and then to pull together a full council workshop so that everybody gets all the salient data at the same time, here's the same presentation about the plan. Bring in our consultant, Greg Dale, to kind of to walk us through this whole process, and this is, you know, where it's come from and where we're going and all that. And then the another required step in this process as we start reviewing this is the holding of a public hearing. State law requires that council hold the public hearing on the comprehensive plan. So obviously the plan forum and planning commission had various different public input opportunities. So we've heard a lot from the public on this, but the official required, you know, public hearing is still yet to come. That public hearing requires 30 days notice, you know, one of these, you know, great, just the rules we have to follow. So we need to know, it can't be a last minute thing. We need 30 days notice so we can advertise it, make sure that there's a lot of awareness that this is happening. So we had put together a kind of a tentative schedule or calendar to just kind of start playing with. You probably are very well aware that Ms. Dispenza has been working on trying to schedule, go ahead and schedule some of the full public, or excuse me, full council review of this. And I, just before I came up here, I got word from her that she is pulled together, I guess, in conjunction with a budget review meeting that y'all have on the 23rd, had confirmed a meeting for that afternoon for full council for the review of this plan.
We just got word that that's going to be canceled and changed because Kathy Landing will be out of town and has requested that we move that meeting so that so that she can be present. So, I think I just got that email. While we're sitting here.
Okay, well, there goes that. Okay, so scratch that. Before we thought that was happening, this is what we were going to propose. That in this, the red box we've got, we're just kind of trying to look at your other workload, your other meetings, and what we knew, you know, trying to figure out an opportunity, a way to move this process forward before summer gets here and things get even more crazy with people out of town. So this is what we had been thinking about for the review of this. If you like the idea of having the small, you know, opportunity to have a small group meeting, you know, on this, just to answer questions or whatever, we can certainly schedule that.
Ask a question.
Sure.
If we get to September, we don't have this done. I mean, this is pretty thick. Yeah. The recommendation for the on the comprehensive plan. What happens?
Turn into a pumpkin.
I think, Sarah, you certainly have as much time as you need. If the process extended all the way to practically 2020, it's how much time you feel until you feel that yourselves, the community, is comfortable with the document.
Okay. You know, as I always say, you want it bad, you get it bad. Yeah. Okay. All right. I'd like to, I think we're going to have to shoot for September, but I don't want to be in a rush about it because there's a lot in there and it's very important. Yes, ma'am.
What is the process for making changes to the comprehensive plan? Well, I mean, or just adjustments to it. Like some of them just, I mean, like I found a typo, like a doubled sentence went in there. So that's just one thing that I found in like my first 30 pages of reading it. But then also if there's like substantive things that we feel that we disagree with or like that the council, is there, because I'm just curious how that process would work if we need to make some changes or if the, you know, if the council doesn't feel comfortable with the document and wants to make changes before having a public hearing or, you know, because we want the public hearing to be the actual document that we're going to vote on. Is that?
Well, actually, that's kind of, there, I guess, two different ways you could think about the public hearing. Number one, and you know, there's no rule that you couldn't have multiple hearings. One thing that we were thinking about going, the reason to go ahead and suggest having the public hearing would be to give council input public input as you begin your deliberations on this document, on what's been presented to you. Okay, you know, council, here's this document from the Planning Commission and Plan Forum. Here's the public input on this document. And what do you think? And to your question about fixing typos, it's still a draft document. And I found some typos in there myself as I've gone back through reading things. And, you know, typos are easy to fix at this point. Substantive things obviously can certainly be fixed. That's why you're to start reviewing this, to, you know, to give your stamp on the document itself. So I know that the I guess
if I may, I'd really encourage the small group workshop format, just to hear how it's kind of all come together and really get some good detail on it, and then possibly the public hearing in the beginning, and then maybe if you just wanted more time because it's such an important document, you know, maybe at least one meeting of council per month on it to kind of keep it going, and maybe you finish towards the end when you're ready with another public hearing towards the end to gain final input. By then you'd have a series of sort of amendments or changes ready, and then you'd have a final vote sometime in the fall.
So you're looking for direction to proceed with the small group and
the general schedule for
just a general schedule?
Just a couple questions on the small group meetings. I've got a little bit of a concern there that there'll be some discussion with multiple council members, and will these be open to the public, not to speak, but just to observe? Because it seems like we've been very transparent up to this point, and all of a sudden we're going to start meeting behind closed doors and not have the public listen to the process. So I just wonder if there's an opportunity for us in these small group workshops, because it sounds like 2 to 3 maybe is a way for us not to have a quorum present. But I would, you know, I would feel more comfortable if we had those meetings where the public could just watch. And not, this is not going to be back and forth, but just be able to see the process. And then from those, folks can give us feedback. Mr. DeMora, I like your comment about having 1 week of the small group workshops, but I think maybe we ought to put a couple of days together each month to give council members an opportunity to kind of continue to get feedback along the way. And I'm also curious as to how those small group workshops are going to be organized, because it sounds like maybe we ought to be taking chunk by chunk by chunk, as opposed to, has there been any thought to how we're going to use those small group workshops in terms of breaking the plan up?
I think the key for the small group workshops was less discussion and changes or whatever. It was real the ability to bring you all up to speed on the entire document, so you sort of get the benefit of that, clarifications and those kinds of things. Then our expectation would be sort of the large full council discussions would be the time where you would really be dealing with substantive components or whatever. But really we saw it as just a way to, I mean, if you don't need those and you've read all however many pages and you're comfortable with the understanding, we could just then go to the full council discussions. We just saw it as a way to give you the ability for us to sort of explain it absent you reading it, you know, without our additional explanation. What does this mean? What was the intent? Those kinds of things. But not really action on it in those smaller meetings.
Was your idea that each small group would cover the same things?
Yes.
Okay.
Then why do it in a small group setting versus in a public, just if it's going to be a lecture on the comprehensive plan? I mean, I think it'd be duplicative work on your part to have to sit through 3 or 4 of those meetings with the full council rather than just with each, you know, with the small groups. And if it's just going to be the same presentation over and over again,
doing
it in front of everyone, you know, a one-time College 101 lecture on the comprehensive plan that's open to the public might be better.
I guess what I'm trying to avoid is us having a draft that's out here today, and then we go a few months with having meetings that aren't open to the public, and then there's another document that comes out in midsummer that looks significantly different, and the public wonders, how did we get here when the last thing we saw was here? So if there's maybe a way for us to think through a way to break this up into smaller pieces, especially for council members who aren't really experienced with the comprehensive plan. You know, you've done a good job of saying things like, you know, the hub is obviously an issue, some of the special areas are an issue. Maybe have special meetings then dwell into those things so that we can really understand what's being asked there and, you know, have some suggestions. And but I think every point along the way, and we're in April now, and we're talking about September maybe, that's a good length of time. And I think it'd be good for us to have a way to discuss issues, make modifications along the way, so that when we get to August or September, the public understands how we got from A to B. I'm just kind of a big transparency guy, and I think that's important for the public to know. Because my experience with the last two times I've done this is there are significant changes that can take place from the draft to adoption. And I think the public deserves to know sort of how we got there, what that discussion was about. So I just offered that to you as a way to maybe think about the process a little bit more. We've got plenty of time, and I think we should utilize that time.
And I think we were really thinking that any changes or adjustments would happen, as Liz said, after the public hearing. So you've seen it. You might have questions of your own. The public can raise other issues for you. And then that's the fodder for continued discussion on, in effect, after the public hearing, maybe generating a council version of the plan as it would move forward, as Mr. DeMora said, maybe for a final public hearing. Mm-hmm. Just like we did, the forum did a version, and now we're at Planning Commission version. Council could have one generated from that initial review, and then that be the final. That's where you'd really get to the point of the adoption public hearing, if you will.
Can this first public hearing be held by the Planning Commission? Has it be council?
Yeah. They already held theirs.
Okay. So I would love for us to have one now so the public knows what the draft looks like, and then for adoption perhaps have another one to say, here's what the council's considering. That's fair.
Yeah. Well, I believe there should be one as soon as possible as well, because there'll be a lot of comments that will come out there that council will want to look at in the actual plan itself.
That helps us then as we schedule it and have sufficient lead time for notice. Assuming that's at a regular council meeting?
Maybe a special. Focus on
then that gets us in our scheduling thing.
Yeah, and we probably need to do that sooner rather than later, because as summer approaches, just like Kathy, there are going to be people that are going to be going a lot. And, I'm sure everyone wants to see all of it, or they should. Okay. Is that sufficient guidance?
Yes.
Glad we could clarify that for you.
And then you'll, as soon as you come up with a schedule, you'll provide that to council and everyone?
Yes.
Okay, number six.
The next two topics, although numbered separately, we'll cover together. So the first one was continuing. We gave you a little bit of information last month, continuing the discussion of hotels and the regulation of hotels. And likewise, next would be self-storage buildings and how we look to regulate those. So just some background information that we've continued to acquire and monitor with the number of hotel rooms here. And the chart on the right actually shows some that are still under construction. So we've got a few that are like the Hyatt at Town Center isn't finished yet. So we have a grand total of 33. There's one in the county that we've included there as well, and information's been available from the industry and the tourism folks about occupancy rates, so we provide that over time. And this is the composite map showing those that are complete and open in green townwide, and then you see the few that are in a gold color under construction, and then zooming in, you have at this end of town, obviously, significant number of hotels, and then as you move north, they're sort of not concentrated in one particular area, but sort of smaller spots, and pretty much ending at Isle of Palms Connector. And today's regulations, we have AB2, hotel, motel, extended stay, economic development, and the waterfront gateway, where they are permitted uses for a typical regular hotel. We've looked at some other jurisdictions on how they regulate those, so it might be permitted use in some or special exception in other districts. Charleston with an accommodations overlay, and there's a lot of discussion in the media about what's going on in hotels, with hotels in Charleston, and then North Charleston, what they're able to do. One of the things that we point out is in the draft plan, knowing that this issue has come up in the past, and we actually asked you to let us look at it in the comprehensive planning process, we've identified areas where we would think that hotels should go, and they would be at sort of these major points or hubs or nodes as identified. So at the foot of the bridge, 526, Town Center, and the Carolina Park location, which is not developed yet, but which is of a scale that would ultimately be what we're calling in the plan sort of the town scale areas. That one would have then proximity to, say, the hospital and other uses on the northern end of town. And then boutique hotels would be, you know, also appropriate in sort of smaller level centers or activity nodes, if you will.
Jeff, I'm a little surprised that you don't identify sort of the Isle of Palms connector being so close to the beaches as an area.
I guess the closest would be Town Center itself would be serving as that general location.
Because we've got two or three on the Isle of Palms connector now.
They just didn't.
One in Town Center.
Yeah.
I think that's an area. A lot of people come to the beaches, and it seems like that we would want to concentrate some more development along that corridor perhaps. But
see, there's a comment for further discussion when they're in the comp plan draft.
That's why I showed up today.
And then just some other information on the fiscal aspect of this in terms of taxes, accommodations tax, and the kind of revenue that's generated for the town by this use. So one, you have the land use itself, sort of the physical, what you see and how it fits in the community fabric, as well as the fiscal that we provide you information for. And so we'd hold that a second and do the same thing with self-storage units. We have a little over a dozen of those. Two were permitted in 2018, and one was completed in 2018. And we also, now these have a sort of more of a scattered pattern along the major roadway corridors and in kind of commercial, obviously, because of the zoning, commercial locations amongst various residential areas, and a few more as we again move northward. And so those are regulated self-storage as conditional in AB2, but and you see the conditions down here below, which basically talks about how you might use these, and you can't have a retail activity occurring out of a unit, and that outdoor storage is regulated, but those are the extent of the conditions, and LI allows it as a permitted use. So for both of these, we have some options or alternatives here, and sort of the 101 setup, as Ms. Whitley mentioned on the plan, I mean, our options are permitted use, a conditional use, or special exception. So we lay those out. Permitted would be administrative allowed by right, but you could put standards and requirements on those like we saw with telecommunications towers. And if it needed DRB review or whatever, that could occur as well. Conditional use would also be administrative, where you would have more standards and requirements that you would put in the zoning code, and then likewise the review. And then special exception, obviously, is a quasi-judicial public hearing that the Board of Zoning Appeals would conduct considering the use. So pros and cons of some of these, I mean, laying it out as, you know, sort of normally in the zoning code, we understand and know how that works, but you have to decide what level of regulation do you want. Permitted, permitted by right, where, conditional or special exception, and then you've got to be able to establish those zoning conditions. And the conditional is more predictable and objective. It's listed in the code, and a property owner says, I can either meet those or not. I'm located here. My site has enough acreage, whatever the standards are, versus the special exception review by Board of Zoning Appeals. We could do some other things that we've talked about, like a new separate zoning district. It could be a general district. It could be an overlay. Or we could even go further and come up with even something more innovative. We're not quite ready for that yet, we don't think. So pros and cons of a new separate zoning district. We seem to be dealing with lots of separate land uses, and every time we run into one of those, it's let's create another district. And is that the best way to be able to deal with these? And, of course, it takes time to do that. Likewise, anything new. And so that might we might consider some new techniques for not only these uses but others in the future when we look at the entire zoning code. So what we would suggest is keeping them as they are, but expanding them, making them conditional uses, but working more with you all and the community on what those zoning conditions are. So are there some that are locational? Hotel is okay in this zoning district, provided X, Y, and Z, and we give you some examples. Maybe fronting on a particular roadway of a certain scale, tied to the comp plan. If you're located in one of these hub areas, then that's a requirement. Then you wouldn't have to worry about one trying to locate outside on the, say, run of the road, if you will, rather than at a node. How do we transition these uses? Should there be minimum parcel sizes? Do you do things with height? The design of the buildings itself. Most people seem to talk about how these things look, at least the self-storage. But they are looking a whole heck of a lot better than they used to look. And so our recommendation would that we would proceed with amending the existing districts and expanding and strengthening the conditions that you're interested in seeing, and that we would look at other options and alternatives in the future.
Yeah, and my thoughts when all this started was that I didn't want to, or I wanted to prevent someone from coming into a commercial district and saying, I'm going to build an office building, and then months later say, you know, I don't want to build an office building. I want to build a hotel. And if they were within the zoning, they could do it. Mm-hmm. And town couldn't do anything about it. We saw that happen in Charleston on that one piece of property where the law school was. Does this, and I didn't see it, but I didn't read everything, does this give us the ability that if they come back and say, I want to change it, I wanted to have that as a separate approval for a hotel or a storage unit. It would take away the ability of the developer to say, I want to change it.
This,
and the town has no say in it.
This would not do that. You would, in effect, be making that decision up front. So you would have to be comfortable with the conditions. So if somebody said, I want to build an office, but they later said, I really am going to change my mind and do a hotel or a self-storage, they could only do it if they met the conditions as a conditional use that you would set out in advance. Located in this kind of place or whatever. It wouldn't be by right, I can go anywhere I want to go. But that would be different than if you wanted to be able to then review it, you couldn't do it under the existing zoning. We'd probably have to go the other route of a special zoning district where somebody would come in and only ask for a hotel or a self-storage building.
Well, and that's why I feel pretty strongly that they should be able to come back, or they should be required to come back and say, I've changed my mind. I don't want a office building. I want a hotel. And I just thought that was pretty bad what happened in Charleston, and I don't want to get caught flat-footed like that. So my personal preference would have something that definitively says if they change their mind with either a hotel or a storage unit, it can't be a gotcha. They have to come back and look us in the face and say, I want to change to a hotel. And then all the conditions can kick in. But
so that would necessitate some sort of mechanism for a separate district,
yeah,
that would deal with those individually or collectively. There may be a way to do it.
Yeah.
Basically.
And it really wouldn't be a coming back for something. It would be a rezoning. I was zoned AB. I told you at the time I was going to do an office. now under something. It would be a brand new rezoning case to a district that would allow hotels.
Okay.
You're basically taking the use of a hotel out of the AB2 description,
right.
So you'd have to have a separate category for that. You know, I'm not exactly sure why we're lumping storage in with hotels. With hotels being a high traffic generator and more significant impact, there's not much commercial development that has a less impact traffic-wise than storage units. So I think the issue there is more looks than anything. I don't really have an issue with storage units. I think they serve a purpose, and if we're going to start doing that, then what other businesses next we're going to try to limit? I mean, I don't have a big issue with that. I would prefer maybe if we're going to deal with storage units at all that we just make it a conditional use and put some conditions on there. Perhaps what seems to bother people is having these storage units fronting major thoroughfares. So maybe if we do something along those lines, but, you know, I don't really have a heartburn over storage units at this point. I think, you know, they're being built because people need that service.
Well, and the thing to remember with this, it's not saying that you can't build it. It's just saying you have to come back and notify the town that you've had you've changed your mind or changed your heart, and, oh, by the way, this is what I'm going to do.
I wouldn't support that for storage units. I think we can just put some conditions on that and be okay. The hotels, perhaps we need to have a separate accommodation zone or something for that, so people have to ask for it specifically. I'm okay with that.
Okay. Well, and that was suggested to me, but if the hotels were the ones that I think are burning closest and hottest, so storage units were, you know, suggested, but I'm not hard over on that, so I'm okay with the hotels only and the storage units we just put conditions on.
So we'd split the approach. Mm-hmm. We can proceed with that then.
Jim, is that you got?
Yeah, I wonder about the administration of it and what the best mechanism to accomplish this would be that would then provide sufficient notice. I mean, is this actually literally removing hotel zoning from AB or AB2, so then all the existing hotels in there would now be non-conforming. We would create a new zoning. They would, they'd have to come in and get rezoned. It just, I don't know if there's a better way to achieve that. If there's an overlay district I don't know. It seems to me like this is creating a lot of complexities in our zoning code. And I like the end result. Like I think it's really disheartening when someone comes in and says they're going to put in an office space, but then they get it together and they come back and they put in yet another hotel in the town. And especially with the occupancy rates at 70% that we've got, you know, it seems like we have plenty of hotels in the town already. I wonder if there's a cleaner way to do it. And I'm not a zoning person, so I don't know if there's a cleaner way to achieve this goal.
Yeah, I think the end result is what we're looking for. We just, like I said, I just don't want to be surprised. And you know, however it can be accomplished, the simpler the better, obviously. But if it can, and you know, we can push these back and bring them back next month and let you put your thinking cap on about them. And as I said, we're not trying to say, or at least I'm not trying to say, that, you know, no more storage units and no more hotels will ever be built, but we're, you know,
in the appropriate locations.
We need to know about it. Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm speaking of.
But we can do that then. So we'll focus on conditions for self-storage. We've started to explore, and we'll explore how other communities handle them, and then look more for the separate zoning, whether base district or overlay, to be able to deal with. And we may broaden it, as Mr. Brimmer suggests, to accommodations district, or effectively that's what we have now in what we'll talk about next, like the Johnny Dodds Boulevard. This end is the accommodations area already, so we might build off that, and you could then deal with hotel, restaurants, associated uses, event centers, event space, those kinds of activities.
I mean, you're looking at places like Town Center, which I know people weren't thrilled about the hotel being built right there, but you've got 100 rooms or so of people now who are in walking distance of entertainment, restaurants, and shopping. You've got another hotel across the street, which also allows people to walk and not be in their cars. You've got Seaside Farms. Those folks are in walking distance of shopping, you know, entertainment. So I think those concepts work really well when they're well executed. And I'd love to see us be able to replicate that in places like perhaps Long Point, where there's a density of commercial toward the bridge, toward the beaches. I mean, there's real opportunities here if we do it right. So you take cars off the road. And I know when I travel, if I'm in a hotel where I got to get in the car every time I want to go get something to eat or go to a store, it's a pain. Whereas opposed to walking out of the hotel, taking a five-minute walk and getting those things. I think that's kind of a great approach if we can continue to think more along other opportunities in town where we can develop that concept. I think that would be a great way to go.
So we'll bring those back next time with those that direction.
Okay. Okay. Anything else? Be ready to move on. Okay. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Okay, number 8.
I'm here, and I'm not talking about short-term rentals. Isn't that great?
Yeah, thank you for that.
So we discussed this briefly at the last meeting, so just to recap kind of what we went over real quickly last time, and then we'll drill down a little bit more as was requested by y'all. Johnny Dodds, we have the hospitality and economic development section here, which has an 80-foot height. Actually, it kind of runs through here, that recommends hotels, higher density office, and higher density residential uses. And then we have the neighborhood commercial and office district here, which drops down to a 55-foot height. So it's more appropriate for the surrounding residential neighborhoods. That area sort of encourages grocery stores, coffee shops, things like that, that would support the neighborhoods. And then we come back up to 80-foot height here for the health and wellness and economic development section, which supports the hospital uses associated with visitors to the hospital, so hotels and accommodations and things like that. And we had some various heights we kind of went over last time, but what we've done is kind of drill back down into those sections. So if you go back down to by the bridge, what we've tried to do is give you an idea of what's actually on the ground with those heights, and maybe we can start talking more about what the desire is to see there as far as transitioning from that 80-foot to the 55-foot height. So, and really, appropriately, we have those higher uses down around in here. So you've got the Tides, and we've got the numbers associated with them. So we've got the Tides over here. It's 80 feet. Bridgeside, 62.5. Staybridge Hotel, number 3, right here. That's at a 60-foot height. Ferry Wharf, you have some of those higher ones. And then number 8, you have the Hilton Garden Inn up here, which is at a 70. And so really, if you kind of look at this area, it really kind of transitions already. So you have these higher 70-foot, 80-foot here. And then we've got Town Hall is the only one that we really have identified on this side of Houston Northcutt, which is at about a 50-foot height. And so you can just kind of see how that really kind of organically transitions at this point. And then if you go back up to by the health, wellness, and economic development, it's a little more spread out, but not really too bad. So you have the East Cooper Regional Medical Center, number 1, right here. That's at a 74-foot height. This is clearly a typo. This should be 78, number 2, for the medical office building. Southeast Spine Institute, number 3, you drop down a little bit to 50. You've got Town Place Suites on Stuart Ingalls, number 4, which is down here on Chuck Dolly. That's at just under 58. Wyndham Garden Inn, number 5, right below it. That's at 75. And then number 6 is the Aloft Hotel, which is right up here, and that's at about 75. And so you might, you know, again, you kind of already have this sort of transition where right around the interchange here you have these higher buildings and structures and uses. And so perhaps you'll have, perhaps you could draw a line where you have a transition, maybe along here, where you establish maybe something between that 55 and 80. Like I said, it's sort of already occurring. If you look at what's existing on the ground, just like down by the bridge. And so that's kind of what we wanted to show you today, just to see and then have a discussion based on that, is just do you want to see that transition? Do you want to go from an 80-foot maybe down to a 70? And ultimately, with anything else, when we make these sort of map changes or zoning code changes, you're going to have some uses within there that would be nonconforming because you already have some structures that exceed that height. Or you just kind of see how it plays out already, and you already have, you can already see how it's occurring just naturally. It's sort of transitioning on its own. But perhaps you'd like to see something come through here, and maybe this area right here does drop down a little bit, more commensurate with the 55. So perhaps you have a 65 here, or something like that, maybe a 70, and then you come back up and you keep the 80 here. So that's kind of what we wanted to throw out to you today, just to kind of drill down in those two areas with the 80-foot height and let you see what's on the ground. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
I'm sorry. I think when this started, what I was trying to say was, you know, when you go to Charleston over the Cooper River Bridge and then you start down, it's like sort of going down into a valley. And then by the time you hit the cross down at ground level, it's you know, it's just like you're just descending into the town. And they're all pretty high. And I was thinking, since you come off the bridge here and you hit ground level, that it would be tapered down some. So that would look like a an area there by the time you hit Houston Northcutt that is tapered down a little bit. And, you know, 55, 60, you know, I don't know. But if it's going to 55, you know, just like 60, something, just to keep that from a constant up by the bridge and then the roadway on Johnny Dodds, and you're just descending into that valley. Do y'all have a feel for that? Maybe I'm the only one with an opinion.
I don't have as much concern for this part of town, actually. I think it graduates down pretty well. I think this discussion probably will have more meaning to me once we start talking the comp plan a little more. About what type of development is going to happen from the bridge down to Houston Northcutt. I think that will kind of indicate to me sort of what the vision of this area is. But, you know, certainly I think there needs to be a tapering down from the bridge down to Houston Northcutt and a little bit beyond. I'm not really sure of the heights, but I'm not really prepared, I think, to talk in too much detail about this until we get into more discussion about maybe the hub concept that has been proposed and what that meaning is. Now, in Chuck Dolly, I think, you know, there's an area there that I have always thought was, you know, when we talked about the three urban corridor districts, I always thought Chuck Dolly was a little bit different. And what I'd like to see there is a tapering down of the heights as you come off the interstate once you get down to Bowman. But even more than that, you know, I'm driving around town the last few days really looking at heights and what's happening. And you look at a lot of the new construction, we are getting a little taller in some parts, but we're getting more square. We're getting flat roofs more and more, and perhaps we can talk about the possibility on Chuck Dolly that we not get so much into the height of how many feet buildings can be, but more in terms of how many stories, because I think that might promote some more interesting architecture along that corridor, where even if the height's a little bit higher than we would maybe like, you will see more pitched roofs and more interesting buildings. And I think that's a really good corridor because it transitions down to Coleman. So it does kind of lend itself from the more institutional or block buildings around the interstate down to more interesting architecture down Chuck Dolly. And then when you get down to Coleman, then you're sort of in the older part of town and you have a different feel there. So I think Chuck Dolly could be a really interesting transitional corridor if we drop the idea of 30 feet or 35 feet or 40 feet and say maybe three stories or four stories, and that gives developers and builders a little bit more opportunity for flexibility with the same number of stories. So that's where I'd like to kind of see some change there, and that can really be an opportunity for us.
So not only height, but type buildings.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily, because I think when you say 35 feet or 40 feet, builders are going to try to maximize within that, and so they're going to put flat roofs on there and build up to as high as they can, where if you say three stories or four stories, then you might get a few extra feet on the building, but you're getting more interesting building types. And so we've had that discussion before about Coleman. We didn't go that direction last time for a lot of reasons, but I think Chuck Dolly would be a really interesting place to try out that concept, because I think it does lend itself to transition from one type of architecture around the hospital down to, when you get to Coleman, a very different type. And this can be a really interesting way to test that out.
Yeah, and to go along with those comments, that area coming off the bridge onto Johnny Dodds, we have large buildings, flat roofs, and all that. So that may as well be an area for pitched roof.
Because you've got those hotels that are just beyond the interchange. And, again, I think that's okay around an interstate because those are the kind of things you get around an interstate. But once you pass it and get down to the Bowman Light, I think then that should really be a place where you start to see some really different kind of architecture on the other side. That it's also more residential and smaller scale. So I think that's really something we can take a look at more in depth, is trying to encourage something different there than opposed to the same old route we seem to be getting in some parts of town now.
Okay. So, Jim?
I like the idea of tapering. I think the difference between 80 and 55 feet is such a stark difference. I think it's interesting that there's been this sort of natural transition, but I don't think that we should rely on that in the future, because you never know what people are going to put up within their zoning. I'm also concerned about people who have purchased properties or who have plans in the works in reliance on these heights and have contracts in place or have things that are being developed in place, and I would be hesitant to open up the town to additional sort of lawsuits or disputes where people have sort of acted in reliance on a zoning that they have and have had for however long the zoning's been in place. So I think that concern needs to be addressed as well. If this is going to happen, that there's some sort of period where the people that already have things in place still can proceed with what they've got.
Okay. Well, two things to address that. There would be, we would go back to the vested rights. So if there was an approved DRB plan or a sketch plan or something like that, that is what we would rely on. The zoning wouldn't guarantee it if the zoning changed midstream and you were still putting a plan in place. I mean, there would be nothing unless you had a PD set with those heights. But straight zoning, if the heights changed and there was no approved vested plan, then they would be subject to any new regulations. Likely. And just to clarify, Mr. Bremer, you were talking, I think you were talking more about maybe this area right here, Chuck Dolly?
Correct.
Which is already at 40 feet. So you were talking maybe not only looking at tapering in these areas more here, but perhaps looking at architecture and design through the 40 foot, right?
Right. Cause I think when I look at some of the new buildings that are coming up, they're attractive,
right,
but they're kind of boxy. And I think that's the result of us having a numerical height limit where people are trying to maximize profit through number of floors. And if we were more flexible on a few feet of height, we might be able to see some more interesting building types. And I would add, too, on the area down by the bridge, there's not too many parcels down there that are significant size. I mean, I think the Miller Cadillac site is probably the one that's the largest and opportunity-wise.
Right.
And I think that when on a parcel that big, you also have opportunities to taper down within the parcel, where you could have a taller building on one side, but as you move over to the residential, other buildings would be step-backed, and you'd have setbacks, and you'd have step-down on the parcel. So there might be opportunities even within a parcel to be able to make that transition. It doesn't have to be parcel by parcel.
Right. And we do have something in place now that does require you to taper down if you're so many feet from a resident. You to taper down if you're so many feet from a resident. you to taper down if you're so many feet from a resident here. You to taper down if you're so many feet from a resident here.